The French existentialist author Albert Camus once said that man's existence can be summed up very simply. He's born, he eats, he goes to the toilet, he fornicates, he dies. Once in a while, he reads a newspaper. If any of you read the papers yesterday, whether it was the Gazette or any national paper, there was a story on the front page that should turn your stomachs. Imagine the motherless children and the childless mothers. A couple have two sons. One is type 1 diabetic. They make an arrangement with the school board for homeschooling, and all goes well for 2 years. The child is rated above average on his cognitive skills. Everybody approves the curriculum, and all's going well. One day, the member of the school board retires who had made the original deal. A new person arrives and insists that both sons attend school, yet they cannot give a guarantee they can take care of the medical needs of the son with diabetes. More than that, they arrogantly demand that these parents sign a waiver of responsibility from the school board. The parents refuse. The school board calls in a social worker. The social worker takes the parents to court, demanding that the children be sent to school and demanding new medical exams at a hospital that was not the one that treated the boy so successfully for 3 years. The parents attend a meeting with the new doctor who wants to run more tests because he believes the tests in the previous hospital are too good to be true. The parents refuse. The doctor writes a report calling the parents arrogant and questioning the other results. And the social worker, who still maintained that the children should stay with the parents, asks for a court order enforcing what the doctor wants to do. In the meantime, for some unbeknownst reason, these parents, English-speaking, and the social worker, who's from the English Youth Protection Service, that social worker is replaced at the request of the school board by a French social worker from French Youth Protection, who also tries to enforce the court order, says that the children should stay at home, but the judge has other ideas. And the judge orders the two sons to be taken out of their parents' home. The diabetic son spends 3 weeks in a hospital ward. The results all come out perfectly the same as the other hospital. Cognitive skills wonderfully. And now these two brothers, now, today, on Mother's Day, are separated in two different homes. Their parents had made a complaint to the Quebec Human Rights Commission, whose date has still not been set for hearing. They don't have money for a lawyer to fight. Their child allowances have been cut in half, and the Quebec government wants them to pay $12.80 per child per foster home and suggests that they use their GST credits and their federal child care payments to pay for it. This is an example of a system that doesn't work, our whole system that doesn't work. This has been part of the insanity of the last week. This story was brought to the front pages by Gazette reporter William Marsden. It demands our attention. It demands our rage. It demands our revulsion at the statocratic engineering of our society that uses our money for totally inappropriate means. I want to make a pledge to these parents if they're out there listening or if anybody knows them. Call into this station. You don't have to reveal your identities. And we at the Institute of Public Affairs will make sure that we will get the resource to give you the proper legal representation against a state that's gone out of control. The father of these young men called it a totalitarian state. And it is one indeed. And we've had a week of nonsense. We've had a week of nonsense that started when the Black Watch wasn't allowed to march on Sherbrooke Street because it was a route for hazardous materials. So, of course, God forbid, soldiers shouldn't be allowed to march there. This was the brilliance of the local borough government in in the arrondissement of Ville-Marie. We had nonsense on Tuesday when Montreal police were engaged in a politesse campaign at the request of citizens groups and giving out jaywalking tickets while cops were being blown away because they didn't have enough backup. The nonsense persisted into Thursday when Yves Archambault of the Quebec Office de la Politique du Tabac said he wanted to denormalize social behavior to make smoking abnormal. This kind of statocratic control of our lives is unacceptable. It's revulsive. And if political Stalinism died in Eastern Europe, its proto-Pavlovian legacy is alive and well here in Quebec. And that's what we're going to talk about on today's show. As always, Rick McConomy is in studio with me. I'm Beryl Wise on the Institute for Public Affairs in Montreal. Please call in. We'll get to our first guest in a moment. Email info@iapm.ca. We'll be right back. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. Email at info@iapm.ca. If you have any information about that couple. Rick, we've seen stupidity at the municipal level. We've seen stupidity at the provincial level. We've seen failure, gross failure within every single section that's supposed to protect our rights as citizens. And yet our very rights that have to be protected are against bad government and big government. You know, the best line I heard this week was my wife, who said when the state starts changing parents, it's time for the parents to start changing the state.
I cannot believe that we haven't been tracking this kind of stuff for years. This whole thing with the social work structure has been an absolute scandal in this province. Centaur Theater, I mean, has a play on called Bye Bye Baby about recovering the name of your birth mother, okay? It's an excellent, excellent characterization of the absolute stupidity and absolute bureaucratic insanity that goes on around these particular issues. The province of Ontario has said, here's the information, deal with it responsibly. Here we're going through this insanity. You want to see the insanity up close? Go and see the play. It's unbelievable.
Well, let's see what insanity the federal government is up to, and we're glad to have with us John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail, who is as keen as an observer and as eloquent a writer on what the feds don't do that they should do as there is in this country. John, welcome, and thanks for taking time out today to be with us.
Good afternoon.
John Ibbotson wrote a very trenchant column this week called Suspicion Fuels Deep Scrutiny of Politics, and I just want to read one paragraph from it. Too many members of the public, egged on by a voracious press, have lost all trust in politicians and public servants. We've placed so many restrictions on them, stripped them of so much privacy, that many citizens decide to remain in private life rather than face such scrutiny. And in this article, John, you had this remarkable pamphlet about what a public office holder, as they're now called, has to go through. 8 steps just to accept an invitation to something. Now, how are we going to get reform-minded, courageous public servants into the public life of this country if they've got to be under the microscope of Lilliputians?
But didn't your introduction today to this show offer exactly the reason why we have the problem recruiting public servants that we have? I mean, the story that you told is horrific. Some petty bureaucrat, if this is indeed the case, and I don't know that it is, operating a vendetta against a family. But when I covered Queen's Park, the Ontario legislature, for 6 years, it was during the very period that the Mike Harris government was trying to rewrite the child custody laws, because there had been in Ontario a few isolated but still horrific incidents of children being left in abusive homes when the Children's Aid Society was not taking what was seen in retrospect as swift action to protect those children, and death resulted. So the laws are being rewritten, giving enormous power to bureaucrats, if they felt there was any real danger of abuse, to get the kid out of the house immediately and then deal afterwards with the consequences, which could well have led to something like just happened in Montreal.
So in other words, some legislation meant to cure problems is could be overshooting the mark, as you make the case for with the Accountability Act, that it may be too much. It's not about getting money out of politics. It's strangling the ability of politicians and public officials to lead and to govern.
To To me, it's not about systems so much as it is about people. I've worked in 6 different newspapers over the course of my career. And in that time, I've seen organization systems put in place that seemed to conspire to keep you from putting out a newspaper the next day. But we got the paper out. And sometimes they had wonderful systems that were designed to ease the news flow, and there were backlogs everywhere. Why? Because it's not the system that's put in place. It's the quality and the caliber of the people in the system. And this is really hard to get your head around, but it turns out to be the most important thing. It is the collegiality of the people in the system. If you put people into positions of authority and responsibility, you pay them well enough, you recruit them to high enough quality, and they learn to work with each other, you can do amazing things with very few resources. If you staff huge numbers of people at an adequate wage, put onerous restrictions on them, and almost conspire to make it impossible for them to work together with each other,
you end up over-empowering them.
Paralysis.
They can't carry the load.
Exactly, and paralysis results. You know what? And if you've got an easy, quick answer to it, please pass it along, because I don't have it.
Well, John, we're going to talk about perhaps an easy, quick answer, because under the guise, and I want to ask you about this right after this break, which will be short, I want to ask you about whether under the guise of accountability and protection and correctness, we're actually creating a sclerosis of government. We'll be back right after this with John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail. We're back with John Ibbotson, and we're talking about too much law and too little ability for people to exercise any kind of responsibility to the public. John, in your article, there is a suggestion, and I think it's an appropriate one, there's an implication, and certainly something we've discussed, that there's a difference between accountability and there's a difference between money and politics. These seem to be two different issues. Getting money out of politics, we've already sort of achieved with the $1.75 per vote system, but this Accountability Act seems to put every person, every public servant, in some kind of a deep freeze before they take one step left, right, back, or forth.
I don't think it's specifically the Accountability Act. That chart, for example, the 8 stages you have to go through before you can take a ticket, was in place before the Accountability Act. It's in place now. It really came out of the Information and Privacy Commissioners. Remember the scandal over his outrageous expense accounts?
Yes.
So that's what got put in place, and restaurants are closing across Ottawa because bureaucrats are terrified to be seen in public or to have dinner with someone. It's an incredibly difficult situation. The Accountability Act has some rock-solid ideas in it that are, beyond, to my mind, beyond dispute, such as making it getting the politics out of government advertising and requiring that government appointments to crown corporations be based on merit, not on just who you happen to know inside the government. These are great ideas. But where do you stop? There are tentative provisions. I think they're going to, in fact, they've already been watered down, that would make the role of deputy minister, the head of any government department, and minister so separate that the two would actually have to communicate back and forth by printed paper
in
the event that they disagreed, so we would have that disagreement on record. Well, how are you going to have a conversation with your minister about what the department should do if you know that it's all going to be deposited on record?
And more importantly, how are citizens going to have access to their elected officials when every single communication has to be now recorded? Our dear friend Duff Conacher, and I admire the work he's done, and he's quite right in his campaign to get money out of politics, but he and I have this constant debate about how much legislation, regulation, and reporting is enough. It's gotten to the point, I think, that individual citizens who can't make it through the bureaucracy and through the paperwork don't have access to their own elected officials, and is that representative and responsible government?
But it's an insoluble problem, because every time there is an example of abuse. Here, let me give you a very fast example. There was a move in foreign affairs to get Immigration Canada to allow the field workers in the countries overseas to make their judgments about who they think would be best for coming into the country. They don't have to go all the way up and down the chain. They can, you know, you're on the job, you're there, you know. So an immigration officer, I actually think it was foreign affairs officer, in the Syrian embassy in Damascus, got an application for a visa for 2 women. They were upper class. Their husbands were members of the government. They were totally respectable. They had Canadian family living in Canada. So he said, sure, go over. So they came over where they proceeded to give birth to 2 kids because they wanted the children to have Canadian citizenship in case things go badly in Syria down the road. Of course, the Globe and Mail got wind of the story, wrote a big story. There was an outrage. immediately the rules come down. No more, quick stamping of visas. Check with the center first before you make any decisions. And yet another attempt to unparalyze the system gets defeated. But who has the courage to tell the Globe and Mail to take a hike? And if one guy makes a mistake inside an embassy in Damascus, even if it was a mistake, which it might not have been, we just carry on with the system anyway.
Well, let me ask another question about courage. When are we going to have the courage to have political leaders say to people, hey, look, Canada, grow up. Not every single problem can be solved. We're going to have some cases of corruption. We're going to have some cases of the ball being dropped. But you know what? We've got legal measures to deal with that. But if you deal with it as a preemptive measure with stuttercratic rules that become these walls that citizens have to climb, we lose the very essence of our democracy, which is the relation between citizen and elected official, is it not?
Then the question is, when will we have an electorate mature enough to listen to that argument and buy it?
Well, maturity and electorate are done by leaders who lead and aren't like the French Revolutionary who interrupts his cocktail party and says, there's a mob outside, I have to see which way it's going because I'm their leader. Leaders lead. They don't follow. They don't do focus groups. I know you've written about this before. You share the same frustration.
And it is frustrating, but all you can do, if you're working inside the system or watching the system as we are in journalism, try to point out examples of abuse. Try to suggest possible corrections. But bear in mind that you can't rewrite the entire system every time one person makes one mistake inside that system.
Nor should we.
Bear in mind that we have a huge labor shortage emerging. It's already here and it's going to get worse. The public service has to recruit, supposedly, the brightest and best in order to carry out the business of government, and they're going to be under tremendous competition with the private sector. If you keep imposing rules on them, if you keep putting them in a straitjacket, any smart kid coming out of university will take one look at the public service and say, hell no, I'd rather work for IBM. And eventually you're going to have trouble finding anybody who's qualified to do the business of government for the people of the country.
And then we get social workers that take kids away from their parents. John Ibbotson, I thank you very much for taking time off on this busy day and this full schedule you've got. I look forward to talking to you soon.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Take care.
John. Okay, bye.
We'll be right back after the news. We're back, Montreal. Email us at info@iapm.ca. Once again, we want to put out the message to those parents of those two boys were taken away, that if they don't have the resources for legal help, to email us, call us here today at 790-0006. We'll keep their names confidential. We'll arrange the resources. Right now, we're going to continue with our examination of what government doesn't do and should, and what it does and it has no business doing. This week, a gentleman named Yves Archambault from the Quebec government agency responsible for implementing tobacco policy said he wants to denormalize smoking, to change social norms. Now, if anybody thinks that this is going to be just a unique case, they're dead wrong, because it's just a hop, skip, and a jump from the time that government apparatchiks decide how much we should eat or drink or play or love or even speak, depending on their normality. And where do they get these words, denormalize? Where is Orwell when you need him? Where does the government get the right to decide what is normal and what is not? Pleasure is part of freedom. We already have cases across Canada where doctors refuse to treat people because they're a bit obese. This is social engineering to an outrageous degree. And with us to discuss it is Michel Gervais, the Media Relations Director for Citizens for Civil Liberties, and from London, Ontario. Michelle, welcome to the show, and thanks for taking time out with us today.
Well, thank you, Beryl. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Michelle, I just went ballistic when I heard this name, denormalize, and maybe it's because I was born in Russia, and this is kind of Orwellian to me. Have you heard of these kind of adventures in Ontario or elsewhere?
Oh, yes. The Health Canada, on the advice of the Ministerial Advisory Council, came up with the plan of denormalization about 10 years ago.
Did they use the same word?
The same word. And denormalization, of course, is the political correct way of saying brainwashing.
With our money.
With our money, they have put a plan into place to sway public opinion in order to get support for intrusive laws. And, I mean, they've done it with the smoking. Their next plan is to do it with obesity and alcohol. And all it is the government selling an idea in the same way that Nike sells shoes. It's a marketing technique.
Now, the government keeps saying that this is just for public places, but on this Mother's Day, I want you to share with our listeners the story you told me of this poor woman in a nursing home. In a nursing home, your room is your house. The government keeps saying, we're not going to infringe in your private domain. Tell our listeners what happened to this poor woman in a nursing home who has to go around in a wheelchair because she has no legs.
Well, this woman is in Billings, Montana, where they have St. Vincent's Hospital, and they have just implemented a state law to ban smoking in public places. So this nursing home, of course, had to follow the law, and they established rules that the smoking wasn't allowed anywhere on the property. So you have this woman in a wheelchair who's actually wheeling herself out to the sidewalk, but it turns out the sidewalk is owned by the nursing home, so she actually has to wheel herself onto the street in order to comply with the rules of the nursing home. Well, they caught her, they claim to have caught her smoking on the sidewalk outside, and they've now given this 75-year-old woman with one amputated leg her eviction notice.
From her, what is, in effect, her home.
Michelle, what is her home?
Michelle, we're just going to pay some bills, and I want you to tell us the story of what happened in Ottawa to another woman in similar circumstances. Montreal will be right back. We're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. We're talking to Michelle Gervais, Media Relations Director for Citizens for Civil Liberties from London, Ontario, about how the state is just going where it shouldn't go, and we've already discussed at the beginning of the show where the state's going where it has no business going.
Michelle, what kind of money are we talking about here on these kinds of programs?
Oh, my goodness. Well, Health Canada alone contributes $500 million over 5-year periods. The province of Ontario has contributed $50 million this year alone. We are talking billions.
Unbelievable. Is this the kind of scandal also that we saw with the Canadian Unity movement, you know, that it was apple pie and so we could go after it and spend all the bloody money we want and forget people waiting in line to get treated in hospitals?
Well, I think it's worse than that. I think it's more like ad scam. I mean, I have a case here where Health Canada granted a research grant to a doctor in Saskatoon to count the number of heart attacks that occurred in the 6-month period following the implementation of the smoking ban. So this doctor was paid $182,000 to find out that there were 32 less heart attacks in 6 months.
32 less heart attacks?
Yes.
I mean, that's like $20,000 a count?
They're sure,
Rick, that it was because of the smoking.
Oh, but of course.
Nothing, no external other factors could have affected that.
Absolutely, you know, beyond question. And it was worth $182,000 for us to find this out because somehow the hospitals couldn't provide that information.
And now we, of course, can usefully use that information to prevent nothing in the future.
Absolutely. Further, there's a great deal of money being spent on ad campaigns. Currently, we're seeing a lot of advertisement talking about smokers being heroes if they step outside their homes to smoke. We're hearing ad campaigns about how you shouldn't smoke in cars. Taxpayers are paying for all that, and it's all part of the denormalization process to sway public opinion to support regulation to invade our homes.
Except that what we're not hearing about, obviously, is the fact that government in Quebec takes almost $2 billion a year in tobacco taxes. What we're not hearing is the faulty science, and just as an example for our listeners, secondhand smoke has 1.5 carcinogens per parts per thousand. Bottled water, spring water, has 1.9 carcinogens per parts per thousand. So what's next, Michelle? They're going to stop drinking water?
Well, I think they're becoming so hysterical. I had to laugh this morning, Beryl. I've got to tell your readers this story. I was listening.
We hope they read, Michelle. They're listeners for now. We try to get them to read.
I'm sorry, Beryl.
We love you. We love you.
I was listening to CTV News this morning, and taxpayers have actually funded a study that purports to prove that tanning beds are addictive. But, of course, they need more money in order to conduct more studies. And then if you go back to an article that appeared in the University of Waterloo Gazette, people have a disease called tanorexia.
Ah, well, does that mean you throw up after the tan, or that you need to suck up more rays? I'm not sure.
Well, people are addicted to tanning because they fear being unattractive. Health Canada has done nothing to regulate these machines.
Jesus, I mean, we really are governed by idiots. You know, there was an 18th century legal philosopher named Boccaccio from Italy who said that eventually if we leave our personal prerogatives to government functionaries, we will be subject to the triumph of the mediocre and the tyranny of the mindless. I think we're there.
We could pray for 1984. It'd be a step up.
A step up, absolutely.
Well, here's the kicker line on this article. Tanning beds are a form of child abuse.
How is it a child abuse?
Well, I guess...
I don't bring any children into a tanning bed.
We're just dragging our 16-year-olds...
And I'm sure she was 18.
We're just dragging our 15-year-olds down to those tanning beds and forcing them in.
We're real evil people, aren't we?
We certainly are.
But it's okay.
Our government's on top of us.
But
they're coming after.
But you know, Rick Michelle, one of my favorite studies. I was talking to Val Prudnikov, our producer, about this the week it came out, and we just cracked the gut. Was the $2.7 million that Health Canada spent to tell Canadians that Quebec teenagers have sex earlier than others.
Oh, for God's sake.
Now, we needed to know this.
Yes.
And
we
needed
to use that. This is very useful information because now, Rick, I think you're going to rush out into the woods.
Yeah.
The 68% of children born in Quebec that are born to parents that are not married, okay? And the unbelievable statistical analysis of all of this bloody stuff giving us absolutely no useful starting point to do anything while we ignore humongous needs among our native people, humongous needs among our hospitals.
We've ignored Paul Martin's rape of the Canada Pension Plan that in 18 months is going to be 2-to-1 contributors to retirees. We've ignored his pillaging of the Unemployment Insurance Fund. We have no core essential basics the government is taking care of, but they're going to get us to eat less. They're going to get us to be politically correct. They're not going to let us ski because that's going to be dangerous. We might break a leg.
Be pale. Don't tan. Be pale.
Michelle, you think we'll be allowed to walk down the street on a sunny day or a cold day?
Well, my goodness, no. You're exposing yourself to carcinogens from the sun's rays there, Barry.
And viruses.
You really
on a cold day.
Be protected.
Stay indoors and don't smoke.
So wait a minute. Rick, I get this. Rick and Michelle, I finally understand this. I've had an epiphany, guys. I no longer want Canadians to go into the streets and march against the bureaucrats in Ottawa and Quebec. I get it.
They should stay home and smoke.
We have to protect ourselves and pay our tax dollars, the highest tax jurisdiction in North America, in order to fund government studies. Because Canada, with the population of the state of California, has 4 times the number of bureaucrats. Michelle, I think I got it finally.
Well, we have a duty to be healthy for the state.
For the state.
Exactly. Productive
for
so
the
they can
state.
Waste the money
so this
instead
is,
of us wasting
so wait a minute. Is
on
this,
recreation.
Rick, I think this is like H.G. Wells. You know that book he wrote? I don't think it was War of the Worlds. It's where he had those nice little blonde people on top of the earth and those gnomes beneath the ground working away and producing everything. Are we gnomes or are we pretty? Well, you and I aren't pretty
Montreal.
People.
It's Montreal. There's a huge, huge sewer system which contains all of these others.
That's where they are.
They're down there smoking. Be careful. They're smoking. They're tanning.
I think I know where the secret door is to that place. It's at a club on St. Catherine East.
No.
I mean, Michelle, don't you just, you know, you're in this full-time,
Michelle,
with the Citizens of Civil Liberty. Don't you just want to open the windows and just scream, I'm mad as hell, I can't take this anymore, get out there.
Well, let me finish the story of the effect of smoking bans.
Can you finish it in 1 second? Because they're going to shoot me for not paying a bill. They won't be able to pay for a corner of the studio if we don't go to a commercial for a second.
Tell us your story.
Okay,
you
go ahead to commercial.
Okay, we'll be right back. All right, you big, brave Canadians out there. Rick McConomy and I are here with Michelle Gervais, Media Director for Citizens for Civil Liberties from London, Ontario. And we're talking about the state closing down every form of human behavior other than us funding through our taxes idiotic and inane studies. Michelle, you were about to tell us another story.
Yes, I wanted to tell you the story about St. Vincent's Hospital in Ottawa.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah, this one is not a nursing home. It's an actual hospital for people who are disabled. These people are severely disabled. They have multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, quadriplegics, paraplegics. And they, once they enter St. Vincent's Hospital, it's highly unlikely that they will come out to live anyplace else.
So this becomes their home.
This is their home. Some of them have been there for 20 and 30 years. Well, because it's a hospital and not a nursing home, they are subject to the smoking ban. And when the administrators of the hospital approached Jim Watson and said, listen, we can't take our residents outside.
Let me just segue here for our Quebec listeners. Ontario has a minister of health named George Smitherman, who was just admitted to a drug abuse problem several years ago. And they have a minister of health, what is it, Michelle?
Health promotion.
Promotion named Jim Watson, who put through the regulation that you can't drive a bike, Rick, around your neighborhood without a helmet. You see, health promotion can give too much for the health minister. So we just wanted to make that clear for our Quebec listeners that Ontario has so much of this crap that they need a minister just to push the propaganda crap. Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, they approached Jim Watson and said, we can't take our residents outside in inclement weather. And we have no separately vented areas in our hospital for them to smoke. And Mr. Watson's humane response was, if you want a smoking area in your hospital, and it has to be more than just a separately vented room, you will have to pay for it out of your own budget.
Unbelievable.
So we have these poor, disabled people who cannot defend themselves.
And I want to make our listeners understand this. Do not think that these politicians are putting these policies forward because they care about our general welfare. They put them forward because they refuse to address the political and distributive issues that could step on the toes of vested interests. They won't roll back the $40 billion in corporate grants and subventions. They're not going to roll back the $24 billion of touchy-feely multicultural monies because it buys them votes. So they put these idiotic programs of personality control out there, hoping that it'll be fodder for flyers in the next election. So nobody out there should be at all thinking that they're doing this for our benefit.
And they're building bureaucratic empires at the same time.
Absolutely, because the more programs you get, the more bureaucrats you hire, the more power you acquire.
And I would like to point out, Beryl, that smokers in Ontario pay $2.4 billion in taxes. Can you tell me why some of those tobacco taxes cannot be used to provide for the needs of our disabled, our veteran smokers?
More than that, I made the point earlier that in Quebec it's about $2.1 billion, and why is that normal to collect those taxes, but they want to denormalize smoking?
Absolutely. How hypocritical. We have a government...
Michelle, can you stay with us till after the news?
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot. Montreal, Canada, we'll be right back. Well, we're not right back, we'll be back after the news. Okay, Canada, we're back. Rick McMahon, studio with me, Michelle Gervais, Media Director of Citizens for Civil Liberties in London, Ontario. So let's just review, my dear friends. We can't smoke because that's bad for us. We can't have sex because we could have a sexually transmitted disease that could cost the state money. We can't ski because we might break a leg. You know what? I have it. We should just go on a tax strike. Nobody pays their taxes until the government makes us all like those Korean androids.
Well, I think smokers have already done that. If you look at the rates of smuggling, that is a tax revolt.
Oh.
No, we need a general one. You know, most Canadians don't know that income taxes in Canada were put through as a temporary measure to finance World War I, and the enabling legislation to make it permanent was never done.
But Michelle, you're absolutely right. And the other scandal is here in the Montreal area, they are authorizing native peoples to manufacture cigarettes. But the authorities are too chicken to go on the reserves to collect the tax.
Well,
so they're tax-free.
Well, you know, they really don't want to stop the sale of tobacco because if they did and smokers actually quit smoking, they'd lose too much revenue. What they want to do is intimidate, expand government power on the excuse that they're protecting us. This has got so little to do with smoking, it's not even funny.
And the cigarette tax pays for all of these lovely studies about people tanning themselves to death.
Well, actually, at this point, I think the government no longer cares about tobacco taxes because they're going to replace it with food taxes to stop us from eating fast food and chips and pops.
Well, I don't know if you heard, Michelle, but our health minister here came up with this great idea that they floated last week. a 5 cents a glass tax on wine, liquor, and beer in bars and restaurants. And that's on top of the fact that when you go into the liquor board outlets in Quebec, 80% of the cost of all this stuff goes to the government anyway.
Absolutely. But think of the lucrative tax market if you can start taxing food on the grounds that it's good for us because it controls obesity.
Certain foods.
No, bad food.
Good food.
It's
now I'm confused.
No.
Bad food or good food?
You buy a bag of chips.
Once you start classifying food as good, bad, evil,
it doesn't matter.
The government has the right to tax it, and then they'll just tax everything.
Well, I want to tell you, Michelle, and I want to invite all our listeners. A remarkable story last week. Julius Gray, arguably the leading civil liberties lawyer in the country, is challenging Quebec's anti-smoking law. Now, the courts have already agreed to hear the challenge it's set for early June. Well, last week, the Quebec government spent a pile of money to challenge the acceptance by the courts to hear the challenge, but not on all 4 points of the challenge, just on 2. So they spent all this wads of money just to prevent a challenge on 2. So what a bunch of us have decided who are supporting... who are supporting this anti-Bill 112, as it's called, anti-smoking law, is that if it does go through, we'll all get together at one particular big restaurant, and we're going to smoke our brains out, let the police come in and fine us, we won't pay the fines, and let the jails be filled up with a couple of hundred of us. How's that for civil disobedience?
I will join you on that protest. I will drive from London for that protest.
It's enough.
What we have here is a case where the government is forcing us to spend millions of dollars to defend ourselves against them.
And smokers pay more in tax, die younger, are less of a burden on the system, and we're not hearing any of this besides the fact that it's faulty science.
On top of that, we're just more pleasant people because everybody keeps following us around.
Well, no kidding. Have you ever been in a health store? Everybody looks like they're dying. They're eating alfalfa spreads looking for vitamins. They look pasty white. They look like their teeth are falling out. You go into a bar, everybody's robust and healthy. I don't know. My family in France, they all live into their 90s, smoke a cigar or 2 a day, and drink a bottle of red wine, and they're fine.
We had an Italian tourist come to town not last year. He said, "You people are very tolerant of your prostitutes." Very tolerant to your prostitutes.
How's that?
I see them standing outside even public buildings with their coats on in the winter, smoking cigarettes, looking to pick up people, men and women.
At every building.
Prostitutes. You are so tolerant of prostitutes.
And we supplied them with those little metal boxes to butt out.
Oh, yeah, the little metal boxes.
Have you heard of the social movement of smirting?
What's a smirting? This is a new one.
This is a new one. It's coming out of Ireland with the smoking ban that they have there across the country. Non-smokers have discovered that if they see an attractive-looking woman or man in the smoking area outside the pub, that if they walk into that area and light up a cigarette and say, "Man, this ban is really bad," they've got the first opening line to approach their selected partner.
Well, thank God there's some good coming out of this.
Smokers being picked up.
Well, yeah, social interaction, Rick.
Glassville Marie the other day, a sign. Okay.
You
used to be able to go outside and get under that little area there where you wouldn't get rained on.
You can't do it anymore?
Without a sign. You're not allowed in here.
Because it's within 9 meters
within
of the
nine
entrance.
Meters. You got to be out in the rain.
Oh, man, this is a silly country. Michelle Gervais, I got to thank you for taking so much time out with us. Go and have somebody take you out to a great lunch. You deserve it.
Well, thank you very much, Beryl. Always a pleasure.
Michelle, we'll come and get you for the protest.
Well, Michelle might have to come and help us because, you know, we're driving them crazy today, cutting their commercials, so they're not making that much money today.
They should care. Michelle, this was terrific. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, though. We'll be right back after we pay some bills. Well, friends, we've been talking today about government getting involved in stuff they shouldn't be and screwing up people's lives. Now we're going to be talking about how government is not getting involved in something they should be. We're privileged to have with us from Toronto Professor Saeed Runnemeh. Professor Runnemeh is in the Atkinson Faculty's School of Social Sciences at York University, an expert and scholar on Middle East studies, numerous books, among them Iran After the Revolution, The Crisis of an Islamic State. We're going to discuss with him yet another failure of Canada to protect a Canadian citizen, a man holding dual Canadian-Iranian citizenship, a man named Ramin Jahanbegloo, who, renowned scholar, goes to Iran, gets picked up by Iranian security authorities on no grounds, and Professor Ranameh himself had been always in a polite discussion with Ramin Jangbagulu that he was too soft on Iran. And just by way of full disclosure, I had the privilege and the honor of working with Professor Ranameh some 7-8 years ago at a time when Iran had the show trials of 13 Iranian Jews, ostensibly on the grounds that they were Israeli spies, and of course all of them are now out of jail or were acquitted. Professor Ranameh, welcome.
Thank you.
Do we have another Kazami case here?
Well, I hope not, you know, because the question is that still we do not know what's happening, and of course we should hope that with the help of Canadian government and Canadian public and also Iranian public, eventually we could get the release of Dr. Jangbagulu. Or else, you know, you may end up having a case similar to Zahra Kazemi, who unfortunately, as you know, was killed, assassinated when she was under detention.
Has the Canadian government done anything?
Well, I mean, they say that they have not disclosed it. They say that they have been in contact, they are doing it, but I am not aware of any particular activities, you know, on that. And we really, we are concerned.
So the government is saying they're doing things, but they're not saying what they're doing.
Well, you know, every day that passes, the situation becomes more dangerous, because what they do, usually when they come up with such strong accusations, the public would expect to see what's going on, and then they may come up with some results, you know, by torturing.
What are the exact accusations?
Well, you know, his accusation is that he has been spying for foreign powers, and they used an occasion that he has attended a seminar, a conference, or a workshop in the Woodrow Wilson Institute, which is, of course, it's ludicrous.
And the Wilson Institute, just for our listeners that should know, the Woodrow Wilson Institute at Princeton gave an award to former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and Paul Damara, the chairman of Power Corp, recently.
Yes, I mean,
so it's not exactly a subversive organization.
No, I mean there are many think tanks, you know, that many academics choose to attend or not to attend, you know, but none of these makes an attendee a spy for foreign powers, and particularly knowing Ramin Jahanbegloo very well, you know, by no means. He was the type to be involved in any sort of subversive.
Has any evidence been shown yet? Has there been any disclosure of evidence against
no,
him?
No, because they have. They said that they are they are waiting. You know, even one of the speakers the speaker in the parliament also has said that they haven't heard in Iran. I'm in parliament in Iran. They have said that they have not heard what's what happened, and then they are waiting to see what.
How long has he been incarcerated?
I think it's over now, a week or 10 days, if I'm correct. And
I want to discuss more of his work and your work on Iran, but Mr. Jangbagulu was the head of the Office of Contemporary Studies at a private institute called the Cultural Research Bureau in Tehran?
Yes, that's right. These are the institutes that, you know, in Iran, no institute can operate without the consent of the government. So all of these institutes are extremely soft, even working with the regime within the establishment. So it's not like democratic societies that you could create a think tank, you know, and then...
So this was all approved before.
He's inside the system.
Yeah, it was all approved before. Professor Ranameh, please stay with us. We're going to pay some bills and come right back to you. Okay, so, Professor Ranameh, we're talking about another case of a Canadian citizen in Iran, with Iran's permission, heading up the Cultural Research Bureau in Tehran. This man, Ramin Jahanbegloo, has a doctorate in philosophy from the Sorbonne in Paris, postdoctoral degree in Middle Eastern Studies from Harvard. He feels that Iran was misunderstood, goes over there with the government's permission to head a Cultural Research Bureau, and he's now been sitting in jail for a week and a half. And we're talking to Professor Saeed Ranameh of York University. Professor Ranameh, does this speak to how seriously we in the West, and particularly in Canada, that likes to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, how seriously we should really take the craziness and the zaniness of this Iranian regime?
Well, I mean, this is no doubt, it's a very suppressive regime. the whole Islamic Republic after the revolution, you know, they have suppressed all dissent, not only from secular people, even they ended up suppressing those people who were within the regime and even their own Islamic or Islamist colleagues and friends, you know. This shows the level of intolerance in this regime, particularly under Ahmadinejad, because what they are going to do is that after the failure of attempts toward reforming the regime for 8 years under the former president Khatami, now they try to follow the earlier policies of the revolution, which failed, you know, and that was the, as they call it, the Islamification of the Iranian society, because it was confronted with women, with youth, you know, who, while many of them religious, but at the same time there are many people who say that we need to have a separation of church and state, mosque and state, religion and state, and therefore we should not have a religious government. Now they try to impose it. Internally they are faced with so many problems, economically, culturally, politically, but they have...
So they need scapegoats.
Yes.
Just to keep the population under control.
Exactly. And now they are using, Ahmadinejad and others are using the crisis over the nuclear issue in order to suppress all dissent, and there is a danger, you know, and we should hope that Americans and their allies would not give, enough excuse to the Iranian regime, you know, to go ahead with, the further suppression of the people, because the question is that if there are no external threats and pressures, internally, there are problems that eventually will people will change at least the Ahmadinejad government, you know.
But basically, now is it that Canadians should not be traveling in Iran? They should not be going there, even if they're dual citizens, even if they're people that are on serious academic missions. Have they cut themselves off from that with this kind of a move?
Yes, I mean, of course, many people travel to Iran, many academics and others, but it all depends what are your relations with the regime. But as I said, detention of Jahanbegloo is of course a very dangerous sign. It shows how intolerant they are, even with those people who have not been politically active against the regime, and even they have had illusions of creating a sort of reform from within the establishment.
Well, I want to bring into the discussion Ron Benishai. Ron, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Ron, sorry. We can't hear you too well.
Yes, I can hear you very nice.
Ron, welcome to the program. I want to introduce Ron Benishai because I was going to ask a question of Professor Rahnema, and I want it addressed to both. Ron Benishai has had an extraordinary career. He's chief international correspondent and war correspondent for Yediot Ahronot, the biggest daily in Israel. He has covered Afghanistan. He has covered the Gulf War, Kosovo, Chechnya. He's been the first Israeli journalist to ever broadcast from Baghdad. He was Middle East correspondent for 10 years for Time magazine. He was injured twice. Boy, Ron, you like danger. Now, let me pose a question
some
to both.
People might see it, so yes.
Let me pose a question to both of you, and you've been listening to our discussion with Professor Rahnema, and I want to address it to Mr. Professor Rahnema first. How seriously should the West consider some intervention with this regime that not only destroys its own citizens, but is now overtly and clearly making threats against Israel and the West for complete destruction? Should we consider intervention? First, Professor Rahnema.
The answer is definitely no, because, you know, the question is that the regime will use this threat, external threat, you know, to solidify their power.
Well, I'm not talking about threats. I'm talking about whether there should be actual action.
No, the action, what will happen? First of all, the action...
The hell with threats. That's cheap words.
No, let me finish. You see, the action is that if there is any action, particularly military action, there would be reaction on the part of the regime. First of all, they would be successful in mobilizing even those people who are not with the regime. And at the same time, they will drag Americans and their allies into a protracted war. You should not think that Iran would be the case like Iraq, you know. Because at the time that Americans invaded Iraq, Iraqi army was almost demolished, you know. This was the end of 10 years of boycott and many other things. Now, Iranian regime is very powerful and will be more powerful. It has capability of getting into Iraq, dragging Americans, closing Persian Gulf. So it would be a very long war that it would be much, much costlier than that is like this. Because
gentlemen, we're going to pay some bills, hear some news, and we're going to get right back to Ron Benishai and his view on things. On the new 940, Montreal, 790-0006. We'll be right back after this. We're back, Canada, and we've got Professor Saeed Radhameh from York University in Toronto and very special guest Ron Benishai, international correspondent for Israel's largest daily, Yedioth Ahronot, a renowned war correspondent. Ron, Professor Radhameh says that Iran's not the kind of place that you attack. It's not like Iraq, and he's quite right. It's much bigger. It's much more sophisticated as far as military infrastructure. What are the biggest challenges facing Israel today? They formed a new government. They've got Hamas that won't recognize them, that still preaches violence, and they've got the looming threat of Iran with the possibility of nuclear weapons. What's on the agenda? What's number one, two, and three?
The number one to tackle is the challenge posed to Israel by the Hamas presence at our doorstep. It means a radical Islamic regime about 10 kilometers from the heart of Israel, from the populated centers of Israel. So tackling this problem, and mainly the fact that Israel agreed to the establishment of a Palestinian authority and a Palestinian territory controlled by this authority on the assumption that it will go from there to a peace agreement. Now, the Palestinian authority exists, but there is no one to talk to. Even if Israel is...
Well, I had to have a laugh this in the past day and a half when it seems that policy for the Palestinian Authority is now made in Israeli prisons, when two prisoners in Israel, two terrorists, two killers, one representing Hamas, one representing Fatah, made an agreement between themselves in an Israeli prison, and this is now reported as a Hamas-Fatah agreement. Is that the state of things, that Abbas cannot talk to anybody in Hamas, in the Palestinian Authority, and it's in Israeli prisons that they're making agreements?
Look, the prisoners in Israeli jails are an entity in themselves. As a matter of fact, there are three Hamas leaderships. One is sitting in Damascus, and they are the most extremist. The other one is sitting in the territories, namely in Gaza. And they are, because they are forced to deal with the day-to-day business of the Palestinians, they are relatively or less zealous, or they express less extreme expression of their wishes. And the third one is the leadership of the Hamas in Israeli prison, who are surprisingly the most moderate among them. Now,
are you seeing any moderation on Hamas now that it's taken over some kind of political authority? Are they at least looking for a way to, you know, they've got power, they've got government, are they looking for a way to do anything positive?
Not yet.
And they can't rein in the terrorists.
What they're trying to do now is to try to find formulations that will bypass the hardcore issues, namely that they don't recognize Israel and they are not ready to negotiate with Israel.
So basically, your general progressive Hamas line. Ron, stay with us. We're going to pay a bill. We'll be right back. We're talking about the problems in the Middle East. Ron Benishai, leading international war correspondent, Professor Saeed Radhameh of York University of Toronto. Ron, you were commenting on Hamas and the direction it's going, and whether it's gotten any responsibility now that it has political power.
Because I didn't get a chance to discuss on this, and I must leave very soon. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for being there, Professor. Just give us a quick couple of seconds on what your view is.
Now that we shifted to the question of Palestinian Israelis, actually there are some similarities, you know. We should ask why Hamas did win the election, you know, because not that all people were Islamic zealots, you know, many Christians even voted for Hamas. If if there is pressure from outside on Hamas, Hamas will become more radical. But if it's left alone, Hamas will not be capable of solving any other problem, well, and then Palestinians...
Professor, I thank you for your time and your opinion, but we've heard this stuff a lot, that leave radicals alone and they'll be better. I'm not convinced of it. History hasn't proven it, quite the contrary. And I'd like to hear what Ron has to say about that. Ron?
Israelis, I think there should be a negotiated settlement and end of occupation of...
Thank you, Professor, but that's a separate question. Ron?
Thank you for coming on, Professor. We'll talk to you again.
No, it's not what I wanted to say. It's not a separate question. Even if Israel wanted to said, okay, we, regardless of what the Hamas stands for, that is the destruction of the state of Israel, read the covenant of the Hamas and you have no doubt about it.
The funny thing was, somebody brought up on the show that Section 7 of the covenant, Section 7 of our Charter of Rights talks about fundamental justice. Section 7 of the Hamas covenant talks about the wiping out of the Jews.
Yeah, that's right. The Jews, the descendants of the monkeys and the pigs, to be precise.
The Jews are the pigs, the Christians are the monkeys. So let's be clear.
Thank you, gentlemen. Shall we get on with the show?
Yeah. Ron, what is this mindset that still, you know, never mind, you know, World War II, we know the road to Auschwitz began with appeasement at Munich, but the West has appeased everybody. Cambodia, they've appeased Rwanda, and it's a result in an orgy of blood over 50 years. When are people going to learn that appeasement doesn't work?
I think that people have already learned. I think that September 11 made a sort of a fundamental mind change in the Western thinking. And I don't think that appeasement is the right word to use when you talk about the West. Appeasement is done by the Russians mainly because of their interests, economic interests. They build the nuclear reactors for the Iranians, etc., etc. But it is not, I don't think really that the world is appeasing neither the Hamas nor the Iranians. I would like to address for 1 minute what the professor said, that if Israel will leave the radicals alone, they will come and negotiate with them. How can Israel negotiate with someone who says that it would not explicitly, that negotiation with Israel will come only after Israel agrees to withdraw from the place where they are, which means from what the Palestinians call Palestine, which means they say after Israel exists to finishes to exist, then we shall talk to it. This is not an opening position for a negotiation. And as a matter of fact, the main trouble with the radical Hamas in power in the Palestinian Authority area is the fact that Israel has to go from an effort to solve the crisis with the Palestinians to manage a crisis until Israel will find a negotiating partner.
It is amazing. You know, it's always amazing to me how many in the West, and even people like Professor Ranema, who recognize the threat of an Iran, will stop short of any confrontation. They don't realize that the threat of radical Islamism has to be taken literally, that when they talk about Islamic hegemony, they mean it, and that for the vast majority of Palestinian terrorists, the three no's of Khartoum in 1967, 68, 69, when Israel offered back all the territories, are still true today. No recognition, no negotiation, no peace. It's amazing that people can't get this.
This is not true for all the Arabs.
No, not for all the Arabs. I was talking about the radical groups
Hamas
in the West Bank.
No, for the Hamas. Just for the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. And not even...
And Hezbollah and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade?
Yes, yes.
That's quite a little tea party.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you, Bill. But let me point out, we are in a terrible situation, and I'll tell you why. The Hamas, the Fatah organization, the secular Palestinians that are ready to talk to us are corrupt and inept. Mahmoud Abbas, who offers to negotiate with us, cannot deliver one glass of water from one side of his desk to another side of his desk. Those who are capable to deliver are not ready to talk to us. So what should Israel do? Alice in Wonderland, exactly.
Ron Ben-Ishai, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Bert.
Thank you, Ron.
We're joined now by Michael... I'm being given voracious signals from the operating booth that we have to pay more bills. So there we go. We'll be right back after this. Well, Rick, it's been a hell of a show. It's been a hell of a day. We've had all the aggravations from our government not doing what they should be doing and doing what they shouldn't be doing. We've looked at the Middle East where nobody's doing what they should be doing about anything outside of a little strip of land called Israel. Some days like this, you just sort of say, find me a shack somewhere very far away.
You got to keep fighting the good fight. I mean, we were in Belgium 10 years ago when they were having the problems of tracing down kidnappers and abusers of young women who would kidnap them and keep them in captivity for sexual reasons and others, and it's just unbelievable what we learned there. And the lesson is the same one we should be learning from this situation in Verdun. We learned there that there were 5 or 6 different police departments that all had a piece of the puzzle. And when they finally discovered...
Remind our readers, situation in Verdun with the parents who lost
with the parents who lost the control over their family because somebody in the school system messed up over a sick child. Anyway, and how to care for them. In Belgium, they found that 5 or 6 police departments had enough information to bring the thing forward. There was an abuse ring in the country. I mean, it led to the suicide of the Minister of Education, for God's sake. It was a big, big, big thing. And what
and
we are not
one
learning,
group falling over another.
What we are not learning is that one social worker in the English system does and draws a conclusion, gets replaced by one in the French system. They don't talk to each other. They can't. They won't. Okay? That's how the system is set.
And even the board that chose the new social worker won't inform them of what happened before.
That the person that makes the promise to get the thing done doesn't document it, doesn't get it approved, and the person that walks back in has the right to change it and turn it around. You don't have an acquired right. And that one hospital should have the nerve to say that the diagnosis and the testing and the results of the other hospital that is like half a city away, okay, in the same bloody area downtown, right? And in one hospital says, we don't like what you concluded. We think it's over enthusiastic. And in the end, turns
specifically,
out,
too good to be true.
Too good to be true. And in the end, okay, that's proven wrong. And who comes to the plate? Who comes up and takes responsibility?
Nobody.
It's systemic. It's in there. It's what Andre Ruffo has been talking about all these years about the DPG, the Director de Protection de la Jeunesse. It is in the system. The people who are in the system are blind.
And
play.
And they are so, it's again getting back to that line from Beccaria, of the triumph of the mediocre. The Institute once sponsored a conference on elderly abuse. And we had somebody from the curator's office there wrote a nasty letter saying, I didn't protect her as the moderator from the angry questions from the audience. So not only do these bureaucrats want to have the right to be wrong, they want to be protected in their inanity and idiocy.
But, the last time around, we had Rondé Ruffo on. We had the person from Dollarue who was successfully interacting with the youth protection. That doesn't answer the question. The question is, systemically, this system keeps failing. Who is going to reach in for these children and save them from the system? Never mind the individuals in the system.
I want to remind our audience of what I said at the beginning of this show. We step in when systems fail. We've done it before. We've done it for the Quebec Food Bank Network. We've done it for social housing. We want to remind this couple, if they need help raising money for lawyers, please call the Institute at 875-4884. Please email us, info@IPM. We will commit to getting you the resources. Montreal, we live in an Alice in Wonderland culture. Everything is sentence first, trial after. Black is white is black. Under a myriad number of names, from accountability to politesse to normalization to protection to correctness, the state's squid-like tentacles slither and choke the spirit and vitality out of us all just to perpetuate its own growth and control. There's a word for this. That word is treason. And treason defined in the only manner it really matters, a violation of the allegiance owed by a person to his or own country by aiding an enemy. And in our case, that enemy is the statism imposed on us all by our governments, the politicians and bureaucrats who enforce its policies, those that blithely make up their own as they go along, violate the allegiance that governors owe to the governed. And we, the people, are not without blame. Our rulers get away with their treasons because so many of us have surrendered to the sovereignty of self-abnegation. We have become a people plagued by self-doubt, driven by a jealousy of other self-belief, and in the process have created a self-imposed tyranny that mutes individual integrity and conscience and trades them for the false security demanded by state-sponsored bureaucratic scrutiny. Thomas Jefferson once declared that the tree of liberty must be regularly refreshed with the blood of patriots. Our tree has become dangerously parched. As we leave you today, remember the words of Hannah Arendt when she wrote, "It's true that we still grapple with the perplexity of radical evil, but one thing we know, only the hypocrite is really rotten to the core." Montreal, get out there and get angry. We'll see you next week.
Just say no. Fight.